Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, July 17th. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, John Elmer, Asa Wynn-Stanley, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 285 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We're now streaming simultaneously on YouTube, Twitter, also known as X, Facebook, and Twitch. And Tamara has recorded a tutorial for turning on live captioning during this live stream, which you can find a link to in the description below. You can also watch the recording of this program on YouTube anytime after the live broadcast ends, and captions are added automatically, usually within a couple of hours. Coming up, we'll have a discussion with Abdeljawad Omar about the situation in the occupied West Bank and the resistance across Palestine. And John Elmer will cover the latest news and videos from the resistance in Gaza, including the battles in Shujaiya, Gaza City, and the ongoing defense of Rafah. But first, here's a summary of some of the latest developments in Gaza. And we'll also share some highlights of reportage from the Electronic Intifada's contributors there. Israel committed a series of massacres over the past week, repeatedly targeting the Al-Mawasi area, which was designated as a so-called safe zone in the south, as well as Nuseirat refugee camp in the central area. Israel bombed emergency shelters at United Nations-run schools in at least five separate attacks over the last week. Tamara Al-Rifai, a spokesperson for the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, said that, quote, the last week has been one of the deadliest weeks in Gaza since the war started. On Saturday, Israel carried out a massacre in Al-Mawasi, killing at least 90 and wounding 300. In a separate attack, Israel bombed worshippers gathered for noon prayers outside the ruins of a mosque in Beach refugee camp, killing at least 20. Our senior editor, Maureen Claire Murphy, reports that Saturday's deadly attacks came as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appeared to be sabotaging what may be a final push to reach a deal with Hamas that would see an exchange of captives and lead the way for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas condemned the quote, horrific massacre in densely populated Al-Mawasi, the open area where Israel ordered Palestinians to move after declaring one-third of Gaza a combat zone last week. This is from Maureen's report. Israel reportedly dropped five 2,000-pound bombs in Al-Mawasi, resulting in one of the deadliest attacks, if not the deadliest, since nearly 300 people were killed in a raid in Nuseirat refugee camp on June 8th. The United Nations said that the strikes on Al-Mawasi on Saturday allegedly hit tents housing displaced people, a food kitchen, and a desalination plant where people had gathered to collect water, leading to tens of fatalities. Israeli military quadcopters reportedly targeted emergency rescue workers, killing at least one civil defense worker and injuring several others, the Human Rights Office added. A witness recounted to reporters that there was a firebelt, a series of heavy bombs dropped in the same place without warning on the tent encampment. When rescuers arrived, F-16 jets, quote, bombed the paramedics and civil defense team, he said. Israel attempted to justify the massacre in Al-Mawasi on Saturday by claiming that it had targeted Muhammad Deif, the elusive head of the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, and the commander of Qassam's Khan Yunus Brigade. Reporting from Al-Mawasi this week, our contributor Razan Abu Salem writes that, quote, the claim that Al-Mawasi would be safe turned out to be a brazen lie. Israel attacked us with the American-made warplanes in its arsenal. There was no warning. An area full of tents was transformed into a mass grave, she writes. For much more on the July 13th massacre in Al-Mawasi, read Razan Abu Salem's feature, Slaughter in a Safe Zone, and Maureen Claire Murphy's news report, Israel Kills at Least 90 Palestinians in Gaza's Safe Zone, on electronicintifada.net. The Gaza government media office stated that at least 320 dead or wounded Palestinians had been brought to hospitals across Gaza in just 48 hours between Saturday and Monday. Healthcare officials stated that many of the dead and injured arrived with third-degree burns caused by internationally banned weapons like thermal bombs. The government media office said that these kinds of weapons are particularly lethal adding that it holds Washington fully responsible for arming Israel and causing the multiple massacres committed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip. A volunteer with the Rebuild Gaza Initiative recorded this video of the aftermath of Monday's massacre in Al-Mawasi.
Hi guys, I'm actually in Al-Mawasi where the incident took place yesterday. I know the world thinks they've been told the number of casualties being about 70 odd. Far away from the reality. People are still digging under the ground. The tents are literally under the ground. They're digging as we're seeing, just to try and find their belongings, food, anything that they can survive on. So, the tents are actually under the sand. So, a lot of rockies.
That was from Rebuild Gaza. On Tuesday, Israeli forces again bombed displaced people sheltering in Al-Mawasi. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that at least 17 people were killed and more than two dozen were wounded. And Israel bombed the United Nations-run Razi Middle School, which has been turned into a shelter for displaced people, killing at least 23. Al Jazeera reporter Hani Mahmoud said that the Israeli attack on the school in the heart of the camp happened during rush hour when the streets around the overcrowded school were full of people. Maureen Claire Murphy reported that journalist Mohamed Mishmish was among those killed, bringing the number of journalists killed in Gaza since October to 160, the government media office in the territory said. Following Saturday's massacre in Al-Mawasi, Maureen reports, three prominent human rights organizations, Al-Mizan, Al-Haq, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, said that the attack is, quote, part of a pattern of conduct in which Israel is destroying Palestinian life in Gaza. The attacks on the shelter is characteristic of the maximum pressure being exerted on civilians in Gaza as a key tactic of Israel's offensive since October 7th. For much more on the attacks over the last several days, including analysis on the international legal front and on Israel's failing military strategies, read Maureen Claire Murphy's report, Israel Massacres Civilians to Maximize Pressure on Hamas, on electronicintifada.net. Israel retreated from the Shujaiya neighborhood in eastern Gaza City this week after a two-week-long raid, but continued to attack Palestinians with airstrikes. Journalist Ibrahim Al-Khalil reported from Gaza City's Shujaiya neighborhood on Monday after the Israeli military left it in ruins.
I am here standing in the heart of a Shujaiya neighborhood. I'm trying to shed light as much as possible on the unimaginable destruction left behind by the last military operation conducted inside Al-Shujaiya neighborhood. Like the massive destruction you see around you. This is used to be a marketplace called the vegetable market inside the Shujaiya neighborhood. And as you can see, families are trying to just return to the neighborhood, trying to retrieve whatever they can retrieve and trying to set up tents to live in the neighborhood.
That was Ibrahim Al-Khalil reporting from Gaza City on Monday. A spokesperson for the Civil Defense Corps in Gaza said that the bodies of more than 60 people had been recovered in Shujaiya and that many more were missing under the rubble of destroyed homes. Also in Gaza City, Israel completely flattened the headquarters of UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees. More than 190 of the agency's facilities, including schools where people have sought shelter, have been bombed across Gaza since October. The United Nations estimated this week that it could take 15 years to clear the 40 million tons of rubble across Gaza. The municipality of Deir el-Balah reported earlier this week that the city has run out of clean water. 19 wells, and 2 water tanks that serve more than 700,000 internally displaced people are unavailable because Israel won't let fuel into Gaza, the GLIA project stated on Monday. The World Health Organization said this week that the concurrent lack of access to clean water, adequate food, sanitation, and basic health services is trapping people in a vicious cycle. Our contributor Fida Al-Kedra reported on the efforts undertaken by Rahaf, a young woman in Khan Yunus, to procure safe drinking water for her family, a task that has fallen on her shoulders after her 2 brothers were severely injured in an Israeli attack. Fida reports, quote, "Early each morning, she goes to a desalination plant in Khan Yunus, a southern Gaza city on which Israel has inflicted massive destruction. You can see the long line from afar. There are hundreds of people of all ages. Most of them carry yellow or blue 40-liter jerry cans. Many have come from shelters several kilometers away. They use shopping carts, wheelchairs, and even baby strollers to transport their containers. Rahaf puts the water containers on her mother's wheelchair and then pushes it through streets that are in deplorable conditions. When her family runs out of safe drinking water, they have to consume polluted water. Rahaf's nephew has contracted hepatitis A as a result." Ahmed Al-Kudra, a pediatrician at Nasser Medical Complex, told Fidat that, quote, "A lack of clean water can lead to many water quality-related diseases, such as diarrhea and skin diseases. But simply not having enough water can also lead to dehydration. The effects are worse for children who have weaker immune systems than adults and are more susceptible to dehydration, diarrhea, malnutrition, and various diseases, all of which can worsen and pose a threat to their survival." For more, read Fida Al-Kedra's report, "A Long Wait for Water," on electronicintifada.net. Meanwhile, health experts say that miscarriages in Gaza have skyrocketed 300% since before October 7th, and women are 3 times more likely to die in childbirth. Israel's ruthless and deliberate targeting of hospitals and health clinics over the last 9 months is compounded with a lack of critical supplies and medications necessary to ensure safe deliveries. But this is just part of the crisis. Severe malnourishment, dehydration, exhaustion, and psychological stress experienced by pregnant women lead to miscarriages, stillbirths, or low birth weights and developmental delays in newborns. The charity Save the Children noted that approximately 50,000 babies have been born in Gaza since Israel's attacks began, with many women giving birth in traumatic, unhygienic, and undignified conditions without access to basic services. The organization reported this week that some women in Gaza are self-inducing labor to avoid giving birth on the move. Women, they say, are dying in scores from otherwise preventable pregnancy complications, the aid organization CARE stated. Dr. Ruba Al-Madhoun, an obstetrician in Gaza, describes the opposing feelings of joy and grief experienced by many mothers of babies delivered during the genocide. She wrote a feature we published this week about a woman named Hiba, who is 8 months pregnant when the Gaza home where she was sheltering with her family was hit in an Israeli airstrike. Quote, "Hiba went into premature labor as a result of the bombing, underscoring the validity of studies that link stress and fear to triggering labor pains in early delivery." She said, "Rabba, can you imagine? I gave birth without even seeing my baby or knowing what was happening around me. It was a normal vaginal birth, not a C-section. It feels like a miracle." Hiba gave birth under the worst conditions. Burns around her eyes had left her unable to open them or see for several days. She gave birth on the day her husband was martyred. Neither he nor any other family member was by her side. For more, read Dr. Ruba Al-Madhoun's feature, "Joy Struggles with Grief as Birth Mingles with Death," on electronicintifada.net. And finally, we wanted to bring you some images and videos from journalists and others in Gaza who are not just relentlessly documenting the unspeakable atrocities, but also making sure to highlight the resilience, joy, and determination of the Palestinian people. The American Friends Service Committee's team in Gaza organized gatherings for young football fans anticipating the Spain-England match at the Euro final over the weekend. Our contributor Abu Bakr Abed reported from the beach on Sunday alongside those children.
Gaza City! As you can see here, many traumatized children, brutalized by the ongoing war on Gaza, are very eagerly waiting for tomorrow's biggest final between England and Spain. As we can see that they are cheering up for La Roja for their unrivaled support over the course of time since this genocide started. These are children deprived of food, water and everything, every basic right. The most traumatized children on earth are now gathering to try to seek some respite from Israel's relentless bombardment and create an atmosphere full of bitter joy and revelry. Tomorrow, as Spain play England, these children and many fans in the Gaza Strip will be waiting for the start of the game, hoping that Spain will win the tournament.
That was Aboubakar Abed. On Monday, Spain beat England. The score was 2-1. And finally, Gaza-based Instagram user Athar Abu Rabia, who regularly uploads photos and videos documenting the daily struggles, particularly for children, as well as her own ingenious methods of cooking and building things without gas or electricity, recently recorded this video of kids dancing in the street. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our phenomenal writers in Gaza. You're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleague Ali Abunima. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Nora. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And thank you for that news roundup. It's been an absolutely brutal week after how many dozens of brutal weeks.
Yeah.
And but it warms the heart to see Aboubakar, and he was very happy that Spain won.
Yeah.
We're happy to see that.
Exactly. It has been another brutal week. I mean, just the serial massacres. I know that Bisan Aouda, a journalist that probably many of in our audience know, she was talking yesterday on her Instagram about how it's like the psychological torture of these massacres, one after the next, without even, a respite in between, is meant to just completely deplete people and put them into a state of just absolute uncontainable terror and fear, and to confuse people, and to make it so that here outside of Palestine, people only hear about maybe one or two, even though maybe 8, 9, 10 massacres in a day are happening, and it's just unbearable.
Yeah, and that piece by our colleague Maureen Murphy that you cited, really, it was published late last night, and it just goes through some of the massacre. I mean, it's unbelievable. And the thing that really, I said this last week, that keeps me up at night is how attention is drifting away.
Yeah,
and Israel no longer even has to try to justify these massacres, because now all the attention is going elsewhere. So we need to try to keep it focused.
Yeah, that's our duty. Well, we're now going to shift to talking about the occupied West Bank in the context of what's happening in Gaza, of course, as the Israeli military continues its systematic genocide inside Gaza. The Israeli political leadership and its settler foot soldiers are escalating their policies of land theft and destruction of Palestinian homes, while the occupation army intensifies its raids and mass arrest campaigns across the West Bank. This week, Tamara Nassar reported that Israel's so-called security cabinet approved the legalization of 5 settler outposts. Bezalel Smotrich, the ultra-far-right Israeli finance minister, is attempting to streamline the process of legalizing and recognizing outposts under Israeli law by providing them with basic services and creating facts on the ground. She adds that last month, Israel quietly announced one of the largest state land grabs since the signing of the Oslo Accords in the mid-1990s. Meanwhile, as Tamara reports in another post, Israel's military has intensified its raids into occupied West Bank cities, towns, and refugee camps since its genocide in Gaza began last October. These military operations, which often involve special units and an array of armored vehicles and bulldozers, have wrought widespread devastation, severely damaging electricity networks, water, and sewage infrastructure, uprooting roads, and destroying homes. More than 550 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank since October 7th, including at least 536 by Israeli forces, according to the United Nations. Joining us to talk about the situation in the West Bank, including the maneuvers by the Palestinian armed resistance factions who are defending their communities and their land against the Israeli military and violent settlers, is our contributor, Abdel Jawad Omar, a lecturer at Birzeit University. Abdel Jawad, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you for having me, Nora.
Well, it's been a while, but we're so glad to have you back. Let's jump into it. Following Israel's massacre of some 90 Palestinians in Al-Mawasi in Gaza on Saturday, the Palestinian Authority Presidency, in other words, the office of Mahmoud Abbas, issued a statement effectively blaming Hamas for Israel's massacres. It said, quote, "The presidency sees that by escaping national unity and providing free pretext to the occupation state, the Hamas movement is a partner in bearing legal, moral, and political responsibility for the continuation of the Israeli war of genocide in Gaza." What has been the reaction to this statement, and what do you think motivated it?
I mean, the reaction has been, to say the least, full with rage among many Palestinians, and also ridicule, directed at the presidency and the spokespersons of Fatah that have been speaking and trying to hold the resistance in Gaza accountable for what's occurring and unfolding in terms of the genocidal war. But at the same time, what's motivating it, which is more dangerous, is this kind of ideological fight that is happening within Palestinian society, and in which the PA has become an integral part and role. It's trying to echo Israeli psychological warfare, talking points by attempting to kind of de-link the Palestinian society overall from its resistance and serving this through the severance, serving Israeli war aims, which is to defeat the resistance and render Gaza unlivable, and ensure that Israel comes out on top in this war, and failing, of course, at the same time to actually meet the challenge, the national challenge that has been opened on October 7th, which would have demanded from the PA to actually participate and attempt at least to the best of its capacity to not allow Gaza to go through this war alone. So what's motivating this is this alliance between this PA elite and Comprador class that is betraying the nation in the name of the nation. And at the same time, this elite has a extreme anxiety over Hamas and Islamic Jihad and all the resistance groups in Gaza coming out with significant strategic results from this war, because that will confine their role, that will enable these forces to claim that they're the nationalist forces that are safeguarding the Palestinian cause, and will render them in the eyes of their own people as irrelevant and ahistoric.
Yeah.
Abdel Jawad, since we spoke last time, our colleague Tamara Nassar, in the piece that Nora just quoted from, says that at any other time, what's happening in the West Bank in terms of resistance to the escalating Israeli aggressions would be called a third intifada, but in a sense it's been overshadowed and continues to be overshadowed by the enormity of the genocide in Gaza. But there is resistance, and it is improving and refining its tactics. It's getting better at using, for example, what are they called? Improvised explosive devices. At the same time, we do see criticism being voiced by people from Gaza or people in solidarity with Gaza saying that there is still a kind of a dormancy in the West Bank, that it's still, in a sense, pacified. It's hard to ask people who are already living under such pressure and such conditions, and Israel has murdered more than 500 Palestinians in the West Bank alone since October 7th, arrested hundreds, thousands. How do we make sense of this? Is it right to demand more of people in the West Bank? Is it the Palestinian Authority that continues to ensure this pacification? Just give us a sense of how we can understand a picture there that would even allow the Palestinian Authority to think that they can blame the resistance for Israel's genocide and get away with it.
I mean, it's a complicated question, Ali, to be honest, and it has a multi-layered answer as well. So you have to bear with me a bit or slightly. First, there is a resistance, and it has been rising in the past couple of years. And this resistance emanates from a concrete situation, specifically in the north. And I would agree in terms of trying to describe that there is an intifada, but I would confine it geographically to the north of the West Bank. So the areas that surround or, you know, go from the Jordan Valley upwards to Tobas, Tul Karim, Nablus, Jenin. These are the areas that have an active militant formations that are engaging in the buildup of IEDs, the capacity to resist, in refining tactics, as you already mentioned, and in attempting to the extent possible to make it hard for the Israelis to enter freely into these areas and to conduct offensive operation that disrupt, you know, the expansion of the settlements in these areas. And to some degree, the resistance after 9 months also of an intensive counterinsurgency committed by the Israelis has been able to survive these attacks, and not only survive these attacks, but also the Israelis have not been able to really shock that resistance into a place where it's defeated or, you know, raises the white flag. On the contrary, that the resistance has been able to actually develop, evolve, and ensure that its defensive posture or offensive posture has become more deadly for the Israeli forces entering the area. So there's this one side of the equation that is important to note. It is geographically confined. It has its reasons historically, whether it's socioeconomic reality of areas like Jenin, Tul Karim, Nablus, where also the PA's, ideological hegemony is not its most powerful in these areas. There's a reason why these areas became a hotbed of resistance, unlike other parts of the West Bank, whether it's Hebron or Bethlehem or Ramallah, for that matter. Having said so, there has been criticism launched from Gaza saying, where's the West Bank from the unfolding genocidal war? And of course, this is a natural question to be raised by people in Gaza who are, you know, asking, this is a national issue. Gaza shouldn't be fighting alone. And why are the West Bank still quiet? The reason for it, in a nutshell, is because the real organized force on the ground is the Palestinian Authority, backed by its social base and its clientist networks, that has ensured that it, first of all, did not take the decision to participate or open a third front in this war, the second front being Lebanon, the first front being Gaza. And not only that, it has cracked down on any attempt for Palestinians to organize, conduct protest, you know, even people meeting face to face would be reported on. And then the Israeli carceral system, this policy of mass confinement that also Nora mentioned, you know, the arrest of more than 10,000 people are the most active ingredients and participants, or possibly potentially people who would be the ones that, you know, would move the population of the West Bank towards a more confrontational, defiant posture. So that's been the reality. You have a crackdown, a double down from both the PA and Israel. And in the meanwhile, the past two decades, you didn't have the accumulation of power in these areas like Hebron or Ramallah or other areas. Now, this comes also within, you know, a larger context of people being in debt, a financial crisis, an economic crisis that is, you know, hurting Palestinians in the West Bank broadly. Palestinians have been deprived from, you know, Palestinian laborers in Israel have been deprived from their daily work. Palestinians in the bureaucracy of the PA, the employees of the PA, have not been paid their full due. So there's been also an economic crisis, and that economic crisis is reinforced by the images coming of Gaza. Palestinians in the West Bank are seeing what's happening in Gaza, and they're paralyzed. There is also a, you know, a geography of fear, of paralyzing fear, as they see what's happening and unfolding in the Gaza Strip. And again, this is where the terms of the ideological fight is happening that I was mentioning earlier, between the PA trying to, you know, claim that the resistance is responsible for everything that is happening in Gaza, and between everybody else in Palestine who sees, you know, both the intention and the Israeli military machine as being the one responsible for the genocidal war. Nobody forced Israel to commit such unbearable destruction. Even after October 7, it had multiple options in terms of what it could have done. But, you know, this is the ideological fight, and this is what the PA is doing now. It's telling people, look, this is what resistance gets you. And that's the way it can sustain at least its corrupt, treacherous system for as long as possible, through this kind of pragmatic use of Israeli violence against its own people.
And that presumably also keeps the people docile against the Palestinian Authority, which is undoubtedly their main concern. And of course, if Hamas could be blamed for Israel's massacres, which of course it can't, I mean, that's just outrageous, then shouldn't we also blame the PA for the escalating Israeli attacks on Palestinians and the escalating land theft, which it is in fact directly complicit with, because the PA continues to work hand in glove with Israel? But that's my editorial commentary rather than a question.
No, I would love to actually speak to that if you let me. I mean, I think we should go further. I think we should blame the PA for even the continuation of the war in Gaza. Because as Israel devises its policies, as it sees, you know, this corrupt leadership that we have in the West Bank, it's thinking to itself, the Palestinians could be defeated. We just need to apply more pressure. We need to find the right people in the right places. And we have this model in the West Bank. That's what is in the fantasy of every military and political leader in Israel, to replicate some sort of system, political system, a native authority that serves it, that cooperates with it and collaborates with it and makes the occupation inexpensive. Not an authority or a governance structure like the one that Gaza had, at least before October 7th, which binded or tried or attempted to bind resistance with a form of governance. So, in fact, the ones responsible or most responsible within Palestine, I mean, again, at the end, Israel is the one responsible for the onslaught on the Palestinians since 100 years. But the one that is most responsible for the continuation war, for empowering Israel to think that it can defeat the Palestinian people, for empowering Israel to think that it can actually change the reality, that it can mold the Palestinian consciousness, that it can defeat and pacify the Palestinians, is this docile, ineffective, corrupt leadership that is running now the West Bank.
Well, Last month, as we noted, and as Ali just alluded to, Israel quietly announced one of the largest state land grabs since the Oslo Accords were signed. Settler violence is at an all-time high and occurs with near total impunity from the Israeli military. Settlers and some Israeli ministers have publicly fantasized about the idea of resettling the Gaza Strip, you know, selling off parts of Gaza for major real estate developers and turning it into a beachfront property grab. But their primary focus remains on the larger West Bank territory, which constitutes one-fifth of historic Palestine. What is the state of Israel's encroachment and land theft in the West Bank right now as you see it? And how is this happening under the nose? I mean, it's not like they've ever faced any sort of retribution or responsibility or punishment for stealing Palestinian land, of course, over the last 100 years. But what is the state of these land grab policies right now?
I mean, look, this is a more, since the rise of this kind of right-wing fascist current within Israeli society, embodied in people like Smotrich, Bezalel Smotrich, who's now the finance minister, and Itamar Ben-Gvir, they've been launching a war of position within the Israeli government, trying to actually control the bureaucracy that involves the management of the Palestinian population, land, resources in the West Bank. And they have been largely successful in positioning people who are sympathetic to their cause in these key positions within the West Bank, whether within the army level, whether it's within the bureaucracy or even within the finance ministry and all the bureaucratic legal work that you need to ensure a smooth expansion of illegal settlement buildup in the West Bank. And since October 7, this has just intensified in terms of Bezalel Smotrich and Ben-Gvir using their position within the government to embezzle out of the, you know, the old Israeli bureaucracy more land, more finances for settlements, more resources. And we've seen this come across in terms of, first of all, this current defining its next frontier of settlements in Areas B, which is the first time that Bezalel Smotrich claims that this is the area that they want to manage now. Which Area B, for people who don't know, is in the Oslo agreements, the West Bank was divided to Area A, B, and C. Area A is where the Palestinian Authority both controls civil and security issues. Area B is where Israel controls security issues, but the PA retains civil control and civil management of the population that exists in these areas. And Area C is where Israel controls both. And now also Bezalel Smotrich is defining the next frontier of settlements, the next frontier of ethnically cleansing the populations that actually exist in Areas B, or in Area B itself. So that's what's been unfolding in terms of this kind of inner war within the Israeli system itself. The repercussions are severe in terms of, the West Bank being choked by more settlements, by driving more settlers inwards into the West Bank and creating the conditions slowly but assuredly for the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. Having said that, I think what is also important to note for most people is that Bezalel Smotrich has been engaged in a financial war against the Palestinian system and against even the Palestinian Authority itself. And a lot of it is being read as, a form of collective punishment. This is just meant to punish Palestinians in the West Bank to ensure that they understand that October 7 will also wreck their own lives and economic well-being. And there's these analyses and readings. However, it's actually more than that. The real threat is that, by destroying the financial system in the West Bank, you're creating the conditions for a transference of the population that does not need violence, but only needs an economic crisis to unfold, where, the middle classes and upper middle classes would leave Palestine, where you would have, increasing tension between social classes within the West Bank itself, increasing crime, increasing the tensions internally, whether it would be directed at the occupation or not, would still be an issue that is not necessarily taken in veritable, meaning that we shouldn't necessarily read that this kind of economic crisis could just induce an intifada. It could also mean it induces more of an internal strife, an internal civil war within the West Bank itself between Palestinians themselves, therefore creating the conditions for chaos, and that conditions of chaos could also propel mass immigration movement from the West Bank to outside of the West Bank. So these are the tools that Bezalel Smotrich has been using. He did not go on his threat in every domain. In the economic part, he compromised to get more land grab and more settlements and more legitimation of settlements. But what the horizon is telling us about what's happening in the West Bank is that this right-wing fascist current is coming for a total domination of the West Bank, annexation of the West Bank, and depopulation of the West Bank.
Abdel Jawad, you mentioned Bezalel Smotrich, the Israeli finance minister, who is, of course, one of the leaders in the West Bank settler movement and is using his position as finance minister to create de facto Israeli integration of the West Bank into Israel. That's been an ongoing process, but he's been trying to accelerate it. And also, he is not a fan. I mean, we've been talking about the Palestinian Authority as a collaborator force for Israel, which it is, of course. It would seem to be a paradox then that Bezalel Smotrich is also seeking to undermine the Palestinian Authority by limiting its revenue, by confiscating money from it, and vastly extending Israel's claimed authority over land in the West Bank. Now, one way to possibly understand this apparent contradiction is the split that you alluded to in Israeli society. The Palestinian Authority is definitely seen as an ally by Israel, but not by all of Israel, but by its traditional so-called security establishment, the army, the Shin Bet, secret police, and so on. Whereas the West Bank settlers and people like Smotrich see the PA as an obstacle to their project of total annexation. Is that the way to understand this type of contradiction?
To some degree, yes. There is that kind of difference between, just recently, for instance, Yehuda Fuchs, I think his name, he was the commander of the, the central command of Israel, which includes the West Bank, resigned. And he claimed in his resignation that one of the issues that he couldn't resolve in his management of the West Bank is the issue of settler violence and settler encroachment, which he sees as problematic and could pave the ground for the next intifada to erupt in its full force and intensity. So there is this kind of vibrant, if you want, disagreement between, the old security network within Israel and these disturbers, these usurpers of the current status quo of, PA collaborating, getting economic flows from Europe and the United States, ensuring that the conflict can be managed without, these breaks in intense violence, giving Palestinians a semblance of life that is dependent, of course, and it's not dignified, or it's not a life that has any kind of, dignity in it, but at least they can eat, drink, have some consumerist tendencies, go to a mall somewhere. That's been the arrangement for the past couple of years, and at least since the Second Intifada, that has been the status quo. For these settlers, the PA is something to be destroyed. First of all, they see it as corrupting the Israeli soul, because the Israelis are now dependent on the Palestinians, even if their dependency is on a form of collaboration that maintains this kind of asymmetry of power. And eventually, these settlers, they don't want any Palestinians to be within what they claim is the land of Israel, between the river or the sea, or even, as we saw Bezalel Smotrich himself having, Jordan's map within his designs for, you know, an expansive state of Israel that includes the East Bank, not only the West Bank. So in many ways, you're correct. They eventually see the PA as an enemy, even if it's collaborating with Israel and sustaining the settler enterprise, enabling the settler enterprise, empowering that settler enterprise. And because they're caught in that contradiction between launching this war against the Palestinian Authority and needing it at the same time, Bezalel Smotrich is playing, you know, a game that does not completely instigate a crisis, but at the same time ensures to the extent possible that he can get as much concessions as possible in terms of legalization of what is considered in Israel's own law, illegal outposts, and, you know, more land grab, defining the frontiers for next settlements, and ensuring that this right-wing fascist, nationalist, religious current controls all the key positions within the military and civil bureaucracy that controls the West Bank and its population. But what it tells us, Ali, I think, is that the next step, the horizon, is annihilation in the West Bank as well. It's only a matter of time, because they're the ones that are offering a solution. And this is where I would perhaps say that it's not that the Shabak and the military leaders that are, you know, against that, you know, but they see in the status quo as something that is strategically viable for Israel for the meantime. But eventually, also, the Israeli security network, the old network, you know, coming from the kibbutz and coming from the Israeli liberal left, they don't have a big problem with this form of depopulation and ethnic cleansing, because they practiced it in 1948, and they wouldn't really necessarily be against it in this current moment. They just don't want it to disrupt their strategic partnership with the Arab world. They don't want it to disrupt their strategic partnership with the United States and Europe. They have qualms about, you know, what that would mean in terms of isolating Israel more internationally. But eventually, I mean, in their also ideological upbringing, they're not necessarily, you know, ones that, you know, on ideological grounds against what the settlers are devising and planning to do.
So if you can see this coming, and you are a brilliant analyst, and others have said it too, it's very clear what Israel's goals are for the West Bank. What lessons should Palestinians be learning, and how can they prepare to defend themselves against this escalating violence? You noted that in the north of the West Bank, in particular, in Jenin, in and around Nablus, there are increasingly fierce and sophisticated armed resistance efforts that are confronting the enemy there with real challenges, using better and better tactics and weaponry. But that also requires social mobilization and a popular embrace of resistance. What are the possibilities for Palestinians to strengthen their society in the face of this oncoming assault, particularly when they have, my word, traitors in their midst?
I mean, that's the key. That's, I think, the most important element, which is having traitors or having a Trojan horse in your midst that ensures that you're incapable of creating this social movements. In the past decade, I mean, I don't want to repeat myself, but in the past decade, every attempt at organizing social movements have been met with fierce violence. But what is very hopeful is that since at least 4 years, you know, there is a politics of unbinding from the PA. There has been an increased delegitimizing of the PA. We've seen social forces rise to the occasion, attempting to organize in various localities within the West Bank. And we should remember that each, you know, Hebron has its own tradition and history of resistance. It never practiced resistance on the scale of, you know, the north of the West Bank, which was more about, you know, occupying spaces. It, you know, Hebron, for instance, is more keen on clandestine networks and small cells operating outside of the purview of, you know, both Palestinian forces and Israeli forces. So there is that kind of also living memory that plays a role in defining the formation of resistance in the contemporary condition that we live in. Now we have an armed movement in the West Bank. It's still in its early days, being met with fierce violence. And at the same time, we had a highly organized attempt to clear out the West Bank from any active or vocal voices or social mobilizers. You know, in the tradition in Palestine, we call those people dynamo, and dynamo comes from car mechanics. They're the ones that, you know, instigate and energize the population, enable the conditions for the rise of social movements, whether middle class movements, whether armed movements, whether more radical movements. And Israel has a sophisticated surveillance system, and it has identified a lot of these people and has taken them out from the social purview. However, we should go back in history, Ali, and if we go back in history, the lessons that we as Palestinians should learn is that it's only places that had a fierce resistance are the ones that actually survived the Israeli Zionist onslaught. It's places where there was, and until this day, even with all the destruction and pain and suffering in Gaza and its immensity, Gaza has a better chance of fending off the Israeli colonial machinery. Doesn't necessarily, you know, mean that it will come victorious, but it has a better chance looking at, you know, the conditions on the ground than the West Bank, that has not accumulated power, that has not been, you know, operating on the level of organizing a effective resistance, that has been absent from that for a lot of different reasons historically. But Gaza is the one that has actually the potential to not only survive, but also garner strategic gains from the war that has started since October 7th. So the lessons of history tells us, if you resist, you might have a chance. If you don't, then, you know, at the end, the colonizer does not respect those who collaborate with them or cooperate with them, and will get rid of them as soon as possible as well.
Abdul Jawad, I wanted to kind of follow that thread a little bit, I'll tee it up for Ali. But the essay that you wrote several months ago for Mondo Weiss about the role of the so-called Western left and how it looks at Palestinian resistance in this very condescending and paternalistic and racist lens. Is, you know, and this notion that you know, Palestinians are only like Westerners really show that you know, their sympathies only go to Palestinians when they're victims, when they're when they're being bombed, and not when they're resisting. And this very it's a very important essay that I want our listeners and viewers to read, obviously. But Ali, if you had any specific questions about it.
Yeah, it's a great essay, and we have it up on the screen now, and it's in Mondo Weiss, published at the end of May. And this is a question that I've written about, Joseph Meshed has written about, others have written about, but you did such a brilliant job bringing so many strands of this question together in this essay, and it's particularly crucial at this moment. And you say at the end of it, this isn't a spoiler, but I think it's almost the thesis of the piece. You say the left must confront this basic fact. One cannot ground solidarity with Palestine on a politics that dismisses, overlooks, or excludes Hamas. This stance fails to grasp the complexities and contradictions inherent in the Palestinian struggle. In doing so, the left overlooks the dividing line between collaboration and resistance at its peril. We've already touched on some of these themes in the discussion, but can you just elaborate on this point. What was sort of the main point you wanted to get across? And what's been the reaction to this since you published this essay at the end of May? And I know that you've also spoken about it at greater length in other interviews and discussions, which people can find the videos of.
Well, I think, I mean, I was trying to fend off a lot of the attacks that are being launched at Hamas, specifically for being a socially regressive force, trying to also give people a picture of the main dividing line in Palestinian politics. It's not a dividing line between secularism and Islamism. It's not a dividing line between, you know, socially progressive agenda or, you know, Islamist agenda. The dividing line is between the politics of defiance and resistance, since we live in this kind of horizon of what we just described earlier of inhalation and ethnic cleansing, and one that, you know, has taken a position for a lot of reasons historically to bet on survival through collaboration and cooperation and accommodation with Israel. And that if we want to be serious about, you know, solidarity with the Palestinians and solidarity with their cause, we cannot exclude the forces that are the more energetic, the ones that are actually placing their neck on the line, the ones that are actually designing tunnel networks and ensuring that Palestine lives in the 21st century, ensuring that the Palestinian cause has resonance across the world, ensuring that the solidarity and international solidarity movement is now reacting to what the Palestinian resistance was able to accomplish through the shock it induced in Israeli society on October 7th. So you have to at least take into account that these are the forces that are, you know, leading the struggle. And what I mentioned historically is that Palestinians, while they were disunited in many instances, they generally defined the enemy as being the settler colonial regime. In the Second Intifada is an example. And they engage in disunity and on organizational terms, but they directed the struggle against Israel. So you had Fatah, you had Hamas, you had the PFLP, DFLP, all engaged in conducting operations and resistance actions against Israel. Now the dividing line is not there. You can stand in solidarity with Mahmoud Abbas, but that doesn't mean much. You can stand in solidarity with somebody that is ensuring that his own people are heading towards ruins and, you know, another Nakba, and without even a battle to be proud of, even if we lose, the war overall. So this is the problem that I think people should grapple with. At the end, politics is about choices you make based on the forces on the ground. It's not about necessarily idealistic forces. And I think the second point of the piece was, you know, in resistance itself, there's something progressive. It empowers people. It empowers, it expands the imagination of people. It provides exhilarating moments. It has an effective and it has an affective structure to it that also goes beyond those who practice it or their ideologies. So if Hamas is doing much of the resistance at this current moment in Palestinian history, first of all, that doesn't mean that secular leftist forces have not been engaged and still are engaged, as we have seen unfold in Gaza. But more importantly, that in resistance itself, there is a progressive element that we should not overlook or exclude. And having a Islamist political party, an Islamic Revivalist Party, leading now the struggle does not mean that we should shy or shun away from engaging with this political formation and ensuring that it gets all the support it needs to sustain itself on the ground and to sustain the struggle moving forward in the future.
That's very well put. And I'll just say, as I'm listening to you, I'm reflecting that the Islamic or Islamist nature of the or identity, let's say, of the resistance rather than nature, is not a problem for Palestinians. I mean, that it's not controversial for Palestinians in general. I mean, yes, there are, as you said, there's a few, and there's always people who dissent, but the vast majority of Palestinians see strength in that. They see faith as giving people really an anchor to survive so much utter horror, and their faith becomes even more important at a time like this. It's a problem for, you know, the Western left. But in that context, I want to say that the Islamic identity of a movement was never a problem for the Western Empire, for the American Empire, when it served them. So, for example, they didn't mind, you know, going back to the 1950s, the United States actually fostered and promoted reactionary Islamist movements as tools of its empire. And one of the most grotesque expressions of that was the U.S. support for the Afghan so-called Mujahideen in the 1980s against the Soviet Union, forces which later gave birth to Al-Qaeda and some of the more extreme expressions of that. And we saw that in Syria, the United States and Israel were happy to finance and arm and support and whitewash very extreme groups, up to and including ISIS, when it served their agenda. So I'm making that point to say that this is often really a distraction. And it's really up to Palestinians to define the identity and the nature of their resistance, and for Palestinians internally to do their politics, you know. And it's really not a question for others to define. But in the context of Western solidarity, it's you did such an important and good job of sort of sweeping away some of those red herrings in the way of solidarity.
Thanks, Ali. No, I mean, I think I agree with you. And I think that there is a level to this discussion. I mean, nobody's at the end, you know, telling the left in the global north, you know, come and fight here in Palestine. At the end, you know, the coalition, you know, that is operating the Palestine Solidarity Movement, the Palestinians have asked, you know, to ensure that they pressure their own governments to end the impunity of Israel, to ensure that there's sanctions, divestment. That's what, you know, people across the world can do for the Palestinians to ensure that Israel and its leaders are held accountable for all the crimes that are being committed in Palestine more broadly. And, you know, but you shouldn't be distracted with this kind of assault on Hamas or the Islamic nature or its ideology as a reason to back off or back away from support of the Palestinian cause. Again, Hamas is not practicing anything new that the leftists didn't practice in Palestine as well. And much of the left is also aligned with Hamas in Palestine, and much of it is also aligned, at least on the level of resistance, and working together now in Gaza against the Israeli army. So, in many instances and in many cases, I mean, this discussion is just becomes a distraction for the wider, I think, solidarity movement and what it should be focusing on.
Well, I think that's a good place to leave it for now. So much to chew on, and we're always so grateful for your wisdom and analysis. Again, I want people to find your essay on Mondo Weiss. Maybe we can put it up one more time if we still have it. Abdeljawad, you are a lecturer at Bir Zeit University in the Occupied West Bank. You've written many essays. You're a frequent guest on many podcasts, including Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. There's the essay, The Question of Hamas and the Left, published May 31st of this year on Mondo Weiss. Please come back again sooner than...
happy to come back anytime, Chris. Thank you for having me again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. And you are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abunima. Let's bring on John Elmer for the Resistance Report. Hey, John, welcome back.
So
welcome back, John.
Little rusty with the mute button there. It's great to see Abdel Jawad always just sit here nodding my head. He does such a great job.
Yeah, really phenomenal. Well, tell us, there's now 2 weeks worth of resistance videos and analysis waiting for us. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to be watching now.
Yeah, well, we're going to start in Rafah and also focus on Gaza City, Shajaiya and Talahawa neighborhoods in Gaza City. And yeah, we missed a week of resistance report, but just so the audience knows, we didn't miss any videos. There's going to be a the continuity of the videos. There was a week of operational security in the resistance operations in Gaza City. They released the videos after the battle, which is an interesting point. But it facilitates nicely us having a contiguous resistance report here. So we're going to do, as we always do, everything is from the last week.
Excellent.
And we're going to start in Rafah.
All right, go for it.
Yeah, so we're going to start in Rafah again, 2+ months now of the Rafah invasion that the American administration has said hasn't started yet, and the Israeli administration said was going to be a couple of weeks. Now, past the 2-month mark, let's just pull up the maps here and give people a sense of what we're talking about, the areas that we're going to talk about here. We've got this full Gaza map to give you a sense. We're going to focus later in the show up on the north there, but in the south here, let's zoom in on Rafah and the Philadelphia corridor in particular here that we have added to the map because the Israelis appear to be intending to hold this line along the Egyptian border. I discussed it a couple of shows back in depth, but the Philadelphia corridor along the Egyptian border, the Israeli sort of fantasy has always been to have this border be a 400 meter plus buffer zone. They believe that that will impact the tunnel trade that goes to Egypt, which, as we know from the tunnels everywhere else in Gaza, is not true. It doesn't matter the depth and it doesn't matter the distance from the border. The tunnel operations continue regardless of what the Israelis believe setting up this buffer zone is. But if we look at these next pictures, we can see what it looks like to create the Philadelphia corridor buffer zone. If we look at the satellite imagery, just a quick before and after, you could see the Egyptian border there on the left, and you could see the main street, everything south of Abu Bakr al-Siddiq Street is just erased. And you could just see it there. And that's what's happened all along this 15 kilometer stretch along the border. And of course, the other thing that goes with the Rafah invasion is the complete removal of aid, which we can see in this simple graph that The Economist posted. And the numbers here are, we're looking at truck numbers coming across the border. And so it tops out there in this graph at 400. But it's important to note that the siege on Gaza, the 17-year siege on Gaza, was 500-plus trucks. Dov Weisglass, Ariel Sharon's advisor, who put Gazans on the diet, quote-unquote, where they manage their caloric intake of the population in Gaza. Those numbers during the diet, were over 500. So what we're looking at here is never since October has there been even the siege level of aid into Gaza. And now you can just see it drop off a cliff there. And a lot of the massacres that Nora was talking about in her excellent introduction are a product of this. The Israelis pushed the population out of Rafah, where everyone in Gaza, 80% of the population had moved. And now they've pushed people up into the middle camps and increased the massacre calculus because people are crowded into the middle camps. They're crowded into these houses. They're crowded into the United Nations schools that are being used as shelters that are being repeatedly targeted, particularly in the last week to 10 days. Just brutal attacks on school shelters. But you can see what goes along with the invasion of Rafah is this starvation policy. And so we see the Israelis using starvation and the massacre of civilians to try to achieve what they cannot achieve on the battlefield. And for the next half an hour or so, I'll show you what they have not been able to achieve on the battlefield and the reason for the starvation and, you know, starvation of children, because it always needs to be said that half of the population of Gaza, more, are children. So these starvations and massacres are aimed at children because the Israelis can't achieve on the battlefield the objectives that they have. And let's look now at the battlefield, because this is in Tell Sultan in the western edge of Rafah. You see two fighters here. They're deciding who's going to open the door. The one fighter says, you get the door. I'll carry the Shawad. You can see him here with his Qassam Brigade's T-shirt and a helmet or a head cam. There's no helmet, a GoPro on his head. So we get a first person view of this placement of a Shawad explosively formed penetrator right into the back door and ammo bay of this Merkava 5 tank. So this is the newest version of the Israeli tank. So we could see it there being dragged away, disabled. We show it one more time tomorrow, because you can see these guys on the stairs. There's the one guy says, you get the door, I'll carry the Shawad. And we remember back to the battle in the north when the two guys were arguing over who got to carry, hand deliver this weapon. And if you look to the left here on the camera, you can see on the video, you can see tanks all stacked up there. They're all facing forwards. And this tank turret is spun around backwards. So this is actually the rear of the tank that he's putting this devastating Shawad device that penetrates 700 millimeters of sandwich armor. And you can see that the tank being towed away there. Just one more time tomorrow, because this is an incredible operation. And these Rafah guys, every week we've been showing this, these hand-delivered operations. Rafah, since the beginning of May when this operation began, the battalions in Rafah are taking the lead in hand-delivering these weapons. It's unbelievable courage, of course, goes without saying, but the acumen here, watch, he puts it exactly where it's supposed to be placed. Look at, he places it enough distance back for the shaped charge to form, and he aims it right at the weakest point of the tank, and then they get away. You see the fighters return safely to their base, and another just incredible operation that happened. The Israelis tried to cover up the fact that this tank was destroyed by switching the flags out on another tank and putting those flags that you could see on the back of that tank to try to say that this tank wasn't destroyed, as if we didn't see this video of it being dragged away. Again, these, I say towed, but this is not towed in any meaningful way. This is being dragged. The tank is being dragged out of Tell Sultan here. Let's go to number two, Tamara. These are part of the same series of operations. Again, we see command and control. We see intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. We see a commander watching the vehicles move into the ambush zone. So that first video was part of this same ambush. This second video is part of it. This looks like a tank, but it's actually a Namur troop carrier. There's a tank behind it with its barrel, and we're seeing an elevated Yassin strike here. And lots of times we don't see this because the fighters have the helmet cam, the body cam, and they're escaping to return to their base safely. But this cameraman is on the same floor, and he sticks around for this and just shows the incredible destruction of an elevated strike. There's another cameraman, and they're watching it burn now, hours later. This tank is this armored personnel carrier that can have a population of 12 inside it between infantry and crew, getting destroyed. And here you see again, command and control. They're watching here. This is you can see on the bottom corner here, this is from July 7th. And it's 2:30 in the morning. And then this is the next day, watching them move in using a commander on a closed line, an elevated Yassin strike. You can see the cameraman is on the same floor as the shooter because you see him get blasted there by the back blast on the RPG. And he sticks around to see the roof of that vehicle being blown off. You can see chunks of the roof flying there. You know, and some people, we get a lot of comments about, like, where's the aftermath of these destroyed tanks? You're seeing one right there, very in very crystal. What is it? 4G, 4K? Is it 4K? Yeah, in high resolution. Let's go to number three. So I reorganized these. So this number three here shows you the beginning of the operation. So we're seeing tactical deployment of drones again, 2.5 months into this operation. Again, eyes all over, Qassam has eyes all over this movement along the Philadelphia corridor. That's the Philadelphia corridor fence that you're seeing there. The Israelis are feeling pretty confident in this corridor, driving in open top Jeeps. We'll keep our eyes on that going forward. Doesn't seem to me a very good idea long term for them. And you see here Qassam using a drone to identify a command post for the Israeli military right along the edge of the Philadelphia corridor on the southwest edge. And here you see the commanders planning the ambush. They're integrating a ground map with drone footage, and they're placing their fighters based on, see, they have a map there, a ground-based map, and then they have the drone footage they're overlaying. And now the fighters are heading out into the street to carry out this ambush. And the two videos that I just showed you were part of this ambush. I showed those first, but you can see here, these are the vehicles moving in. And here we see a Yassin strike, way too close for any kind of active protection system to intercept that, escaping down the alleys, something we've seen. Of course, all over Palestine. Here we see another elevated Yassin strike. Elevated strikes are advantageous for the shooters because of the way the armor of the tank works. Again, when you don't see a massive explosion of fire, you're often seeing a penetration. Here we see a cluster of soldiers in an Al Ghul sniper attack with a very heavy edit. Because we can't show what happened after that. Here we see fighters moving again through their helmet cams. They're not helmet cams, they're head cams, body cams, moving through the streets. So we get a first person view. And here we have soldiers in a window coming up on 10 months, brushing their teeth in the window to get a good view. And they're going to pay the price for that with what we see here is a twin operation. We're seeing a thermobaric, a single-charge thermobaric warhead, and an F-7 North Korean fragmentation warhead. That warhead explodes into fragments covering a wide distance. So the soldiers in a window brushing their teeth, giving away their position, and then are hit 1-2 by a thermobaric charge and then by a fragmentation charge that comes in after the thermobaric charge when there's when the Israelis are milling about. After the thermobaric charge, then the F-7 comes in after and hits. So we're seeing complex operations. We're seeing command and control. We're seeing drones being used for surveillance. We're seeing the fighters here on the ground able to move through the rubble. The rubble is just disgusting here. I don't know how else to say it. After 9 months, when you look at the destruction, this is just military vandalism. We've been saying it since November. Because the military vandalism started in October before the ground war even began. And what we're watching there is the evacuation of the... Yeah, let's watch it one more time because the detail in this is remarkable. Tactical deployment of drones. This is not captured drones. This is Hamas. This is Qassam fielding their own drones and monitoring these vehicles, monitoring these tanks, armored vehicles, bulldozers. There's the open-top Jeep. The only other time we saw open top Jeeps was on the border at Beit Hanun, and he got hit by an anti-tank guided missile. It didn't turn out well for them in that instance. The resistance is able to identify the command post buildings. And then if you see here, that's the tank with the flags that we saw in the first video getting blown up. And so they're all over this. The resistance is not being degraded. Their commanders are not being, if they're being killed, they're being replaced by able leadership. And then the fighters are doing what they've been doing. They have enough Yassins. We're still seeing Yassin 105s being used against tanks. We'll see later on the Tandem 85s being used against bulldozers. They're constantly picking the correct ammunition, the correct weapon system. For the moment, we don't see any signs of degrading where they're using just any weapon that they have their hands on. They're choosing the weapons, they're choosing the operations, And this is now, again, remember, Netanyahu said that it was just going to be a few weeks in Rafah, and now 2+ months, and they're still getting blasted in these scenes. Look at another gaggle of soldiers here, and an Al Ghul sniper. And we've seen the Al Ghul sniper operations. They don't miss, and they didn't miss that one either. We just edited that out to make these PG. Great shot of the fighters moving through the streets here, something that Qassam doesn't usually give us, these long shots, but you can see the fighters moving into position. Again, the Israelis covering themselves with the very subtle pink blanket to hide their position. And these two guys are ready with the exact weapon that you would use for this circumstance. So they're using appropriate weapons. Their intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance is still all over the Israeli movements. This is an Israeli command position. And Al-Aqsa News in Gaza said that this was one of the most complex and layered ambushes of the war, Qassam is saying. The level of detail to get into position. They're getting into position via tunnel, but we also see them move through the alleys and the streets, and that's the medevac of the wounded and killed soldiers who do not appear in the Israeli casualty reports. So you see the fighters here returning to their base safely via the same route that they got there. They got to that command post. You can see the concealment smoke there from the vehicles to conceal the medevac or to signal. Sometimes that smoke is used to signal the helicopter where to land. So that's significant. And then just number four, Tamara, is just a quick one here, because this is the commander of the 401st Armored Brigade here. He's just popping out of his tank in the same ambush, in the same neighborhood. And again, a PG edit there, but he's hit by that Qassam shooter, just using small arms and hitting them. And just to say that there was 5 clips from Rafah released past the EI deadline for this show. So we'll dig into those on the next show next week. So Rafah just still continually ferocious resistance, detailed resistance. You can see there with this map, Tel HaSultan is the important area of where the fighting is. The Israeli military has a position along the waterfront there, where on the edge of Tel HaSultan, that's where the ambush just took place. And the Israelis are appearing to, the only objectives that they are able to reach so far in this war is that they have made the Netzarim corridor and the Philadelphia corridor. They're attempting to hold those two corridors for a corridor and raid strategy going forward, where they can move into the central areas of Gaza without coming all the way across the border in hostile territory. So they can use the Philadelphia corridor and the Netzarim corridor to resupply. But both of those, the Philadelphia corridor has been under attack, as we just saw, by impressive operations. Netzarim corridor is constantly under attack. And the longer the troops are in these positions, the more likely a spectacular operation happens. But right now, the operations are constant in both of those areas. So let's move to Tel al-Hawa now. Tel al-Hawa is basically downtown Gaza City. It's the downtown core of the Gaza Strip. If we look at map number 9 here, you can see it. It's beside Ramal. It attaches to Ramal, which is the commercial downtown hub of the Gaza Strip. And it's been basically erased. But you can see Tel al-Hawa abuts the Netzarim corridor. And so it was the 99th Division that raided Tel al-Hawa. This operation began on July the 8th and wrapped up on this weekend. And you can see we've updated this map because the pier is gone and the pier is not coming back. So that farce has ended, $300 million farce. It's not just about the money, though. It's about the way that it was used to buttress the ceiling of the other border crossings, which could bring in aid at far higher amounts than the pier ever could. In any case, we'll move on from the pier. But Tel al-Hawa was given an evacuation notice. Again, a massacre, then an evacuation notice. The evacuation notice was on July 8th, and the war began in this area right away. Again, the resistance is able to meet the Israelis at any place they arrive. So this is Tel Ohawa. Let's look at number 10, Tamara. So this is them again with eyes on, this appears to be drone footage with eyes on the Israelis. You can see them moving through the corridor there. That's from the Netzarim corridor up. And then we're going to see the use here. We see a Merkava tank and a D9 armored bulldozer. Now we see Qassam fighters wiring up Israeli anti-tank mines, American Israeli anti-tank mines that the Israelis use for house demolitions. The Palestinian resistance is rewiring, repurposing it here, and about to hit two D9 armored bulldozers, which are less armored than any of the other armored vehicles, and has got to be the worst assignment for the Israeli military. The short straw definitely is the bulldozer drivers. You can see the two there are hit with anti-tank mines. And the fighter says, "We tell you, O Netanyahu, by God, we will prepare for you various forms of death, which will make you curse yourselves for ever thinking of entering Gaza. Advance, advance. We have more in store for you," the fighter says on the audio that we have removed. So that's significant operation. And again, repurposing of Israeli munitions. And this is something that I'll dig into more on the next on next week's show. But we've been talking about it the whole time through this war. There's significant unexploded ordnance throughout Gaza, which is deadly to civilians, but is a boon to the military industrial complex in Gaza, which repurposes these weapons. And here you can see a stack of anti-tank mines being used against these two armored bulldozers. So American mines, anti-tank mines being used against American bulldozers from Peoria, Illinois, Caterpillar bulldozers, and Israeli mines that are American mines being used against the Israeli up-armoring of the Caterpillar bulldozer. So let's look at number 11 here, Tamara, because this is an interesting one. This is a Qassam sniper video. You see the Al Ghul sniper rifle, and just you can see the Israeli forces there moving. You can see the round he's holding in his hand there, just to give you an idea of what these Al Ghul rounds look like in the hand of a sturdy fighter. And he says, this fighter says, "I've been looking for Netanyahu's son, Yair, for a while now to put a bullet in him. I search in vain. He won't send his own son into this hell. Instead, he sent these idiots to their deaths." And again, we edited this out, but that was not amiss by this Al Ghul sniper. And then we see the medevac of the soldier whose death or injury was not claimed by the Israelis on their official count list. So that's an interesting operation, looking for Yair Netanyahu, who is, of course, in the news in Israel in the last week. So again, the fighters are interacting with updated news stories. They're constantly communicating with their propaganda. They're constantly communicating with their population. They're communicating with their leadership and historic leadership, something that we've seen all throughout the war. Continuing, still no sign of, no end in sight for any of that. So number 12 here, again, eyes all over the movement. There's a soldier carrying a Matador anti-tank weapon that they use. That's the weapon that the Israelis use against houses here. And this is a television strike, an IED, a Qassam-built IED that's placed there to hit that dismounted crew. And then again, soldier in a window exposing his position, and he's going to get hit here. You can see, again, commanders briefing their fighters, planning the objective, talking about what weapons to use, and again, deploying the two correct weapons for this situation. This is an F7 fragmentation warhead. Again, it has the distance to hit, and when it hits, it explodes in tiny shards. It's a devastating weapon. Again, you can see perfectly accurate. Again, no casualties from the Israelis. So I'll let the listeners and viewers decide what's going on with that, because we've been tracking it all throughout the war, and none of the numbers add up. So that's number 12. Number 13, again, another commander-controlled ambush here. Detailed ambush. That on the wall says Qassam, the Qassam brigades are hell on invaders. You can see them wiring up here. The fighters are wiring up Qassam-built anti-personnel IEDs. So that's different than the Shawad that's used against the tank. These are troop, anti-troop weapons. And you can see they're placed in two positions, one on the upper floor and then one on the lower floor, that predicts the exit route from the first blast. So the fighters are planning, the commanders are planning this operation. We're going to watch here the tank pull cover onto the street here, and the Qassam brigades are just watching it on TV. The commander's watching this whole operation on TV. They're watching, they're communicating with closed lines. They're going to give you a 10 red triangles here to show you each of the troops that are moving across the street here, walking right into the blast. And then the second part of this operation is to predict where the reinforcements will go from this initial blast. So a blast on the upper floor that's aimed down the television, they call it a television bomb. It's an anti-personnel bomb that would be aimed down and blast into a straight ahead, rather than a circular blast. And you can see them there with the stretchers evacuating the wounded. But this operation is multi-pronged. It's a command and control operation, pre-planned ambush, preset ambush. And there it is. They predict exactly where the soldiers are going to run to. And so they run right into a Radia, which is also a Qassam-built weapon. And you can see them. Again, Qassam has eyes on multiple spots. So Tel Al-Hawa didn't know there was going to be an invasion of Tel Al-Hawa. And the second they move in, they get hit by these pre-planned operations, something that we saw in Shuja'iyah as well. Just really well-planned operation. And the selection, you can see that they predict exactly where the forces will flee to, which is something we've seen in many operations. And it's a key part of the way that Qassam plans these ambushes is to predict the route of the exit route or the entrance route of the reinforcements, as we saw in the Beit Hanun ambush or in the Khan Yunis Night of Power ambush, where they predicted five routes in that ambush and got all of them right. And all of those Israeli soldiers walked into ambushes as part of the original ambush. And so we're seeing that again in Tel Al-Hawa. We're seeing that on the days that the operation begins. It doesn't take a two-month operation before this is cooked up. They have this operation ready to go the moment the Israelis invade. And this is in an area that has been completely devastated. Ramal and Tel Al-Hawa have just been erased. The downtown commercial core, the telecommunications, the aid, the international companies, the universities, all downtown, all wiped out completely by the Israelis throughout the course of this operations. And we will remember back in October 8th, 7th, 8th, 9th, they went right at Tel Al-Hawa and Al Ramal, the main downtown commercial areas. That was the first place that they hit after the October 7th. Operation that dismantled the Gaza division. So that's Tel Al-Hawa. Let's take a look here at that map again tomorrow. Let's throw up number 9 and just have a look. So that's Tel Al-Hawa in the southwest there. And now we're going to go to the east to Shuja'iyah, you know, home of our dear friend Rafat and home of the bravest, named after the bravery. There's a long legacy in Shuja'iyah that predates even Israel by generations. Shuja'iyah is a hill that overlooks the Gaza Strip, and whoever historically controlled that hill controlled the routes from that crossed the Mediterranean from Alexandria in Egypt up the coast. And through into Gaza City here. And so Shuja'iyah is an important area and an area that the Israelis have never been able to defeat. And they came in again. We saw this operation begin 2 weeks ago with the Qassam fighters in the swings talking about the history of Shuja'iyah, talking about their commanders, Ahmed Jabari, is from Shujaiya. He is a critical commander in what we've been seeing for the last 9 months, the professionalization of the force, the fact that they built a weapons industry that is resilient enough to be able to carry out operations for 10 months that we've seen. And so Shujaiya is right at the heart of that. Civil defense in Shujaiya said that 85% of the buildings in Shujaiya are uninhabitable. But let's look at these operations, number 20. This is actually the one operation from 2 weeks ago. We got Sahrail Quds just flexing that they have three combat nodes on a closed telephone line that the Israelis have no connection to. And you see that mouse hole, they mouse holed through the wall here and they're coming up the stairs. They're ambushing an Israeli force on the upper floors. We have a little volume here that's going to kick in. You can hear them speaking in Hebrew and firing their weapons here. And Sahrail Quds has popped through the wall, probably from a tunnel, and then popped through the wall. There's no surveillance downstairs for these Israeli positions. And these fighters are about to carry out a legendary operation that people will talk about around campfires for generations to come, where they literally climb the stairs and attack the Israeli force on the upper floors. And we saw this type of operation, if people remember the... So they're just firing on them, firing on the Israeli force by raiding from downstairs. And we saw this from the other side, because remember back in Khan Yunis, the Israelis released footage of what it looked like when they got ambushed inside a room by Sahrail Quds fighters in Khan Yunis who came up the stairs and shot them. And it kind of got the name Blanket Boy because it was that shot with the Israeli soldier who was shot held a blanket to his neck, and a bunch of the soldiers retreated and hid in the corner. Just remarkable operation that you see there. Let's watch it one more time. So closed line to three combat nodes. So command and control obviously in place. You can see a mouse hole there that they've come through. And now they're coming up the stairs to ambush from downstairs to upstairs. Just an absolutely legendary operation that, like I said, people will talk about these operations. This is operations you tell your grandkids about. Just the courage of it and just the lack of spatial awareness for the Israeli military, the combination between bravery and skill of the Palestinian fighters and, you know, what those Israelis are doing on the upper floor is just firing. You can hear there. That's them firing out the windows. They might be taking a TikTok video for their audience at home, dumping their weapons out the window, and then they're hit from downstairs, and then the fighters return to their base safely. It's not a martyrdom mission. It could have been a martyrdom mission, but they choose to fight this battle in a different way. They could have gone blazing right up through the stairs into the room, but here you see fighters returning to their base safely. So remarkable operation. That was that would have been the one that I showed last week when I was off, but we'll show it to you this week. And you can see the fighters there moving through the buildings. They have tunnel access, and then they have the ability to climb through the walls of these buildings and use it tactically. You can see them using tactical vests here again. So we're seeing better trained fighters at this point in the battle than we saw earlier on in the war. Let's look at number 21, Tamara. This is a shawath being laid here, and again using the shawath to hit a unexploded Israeli bomb. You can see the Merkava tank there driving over it. Looks a little bit like that one missed, but it could be one of the 500 tanks that the Israelis say are damaged. And again, you can see just in that shot, the rubbleization. Let's go to 22. That one, we don't need to dwell on that one, but let's watch this one because we're about to see here seven strikes. We're seeing here a twin strike here, two Yassins against like a 1-2 punch against a tank and an armored and a troop carrier, an armored troop carrier. Here we're going to see one against a tank. Again, Yassin 105 using the correct weapon for the vehicle. The fighter is moving through this building. That fighter there is looking out the window, old-fashioned surveillance, not using electronic equipment, just climbing up and looking over. That was a shot on the side cabin. We're going to watch this one twice because it's there's a lot going on. There's another Yassin strike from inside against the rear door of a Namur troop carrier, population 12, in the weakest point. Again, the rubble everywhere, allowed to be used as concealment, confusing the Israelis to where they are. They're having a difficult time understanding where they are because they've destroyed things so much. Here we're going to see another elevated strike on a Namur troop carrier hitting in the middle of the roof. And again, we saw that at the beginning of this package. What happens when that hits? We don't see the aftermath of that. But here we see that. Let's do it again from the start. We're going to see two here. So a twin Yassin strikes here, which is interesting and something we're seeing more of. The first fighter goes and then the second fighter goes. There you could see him. Here we see it against an armored vehicle. Again, fairly close distance, popping the door open to hit that commander's hatch there. And then this one is, watch him climb over the wall to look. And then firing here in the middle of the cabin. That's where the crew, that's where the infantry soldiers are, in the middle of that cabin. So that is a perfect shot on a Namur. This is also a perfect shot on a Namur rear door through a house. There's no way the radar picks up to protect the, for the trophy system to intercept that round. So they're picking the right spot to shoot from. This commander's flat hatch is open here on this shot. So that Yassin strike hits an open commander's hatch. Didn't appear the commander's head was in up there, but he's in that hatch. So it explodes in the hatch. These are all Shujaiya operations, and these were all released at once on the same video. They held their operations for operational security. They held back these operations until the Israelis withdrew. So that was interesting, and one of the reasons why you didn't miss any videos in my absence last week. Let's do number 23. These are all from the same video of Shujaiya. Here we see the tandem-charged thermobaric warhead built by the Qassam Brigades against an Israeli position. You can see it doing exactly what it's designed to do. Blows out the wall with the first charge. The second charge is a thermobaric fuel air explosion. You can see the overpressure blast, and then you can see the curtain flying there. Again, another successful operation. The Israelis claimed 6 killed in Shujaiya. It's possible that we're looking at that there, because that is an effect. That is a devastating strike with a thermobaric weapon. Let's do 24 here tomorrow. Again, Shujaiya. This is thermobaric strike. And again, this is a single charge, an Iranian RPG-7 thermobaric, not built by Qassam. You can see that's the standard RPG-7 thermobaric warhead, which just has one warhead. Qassam built theirs in the tandem charge. Again, soldiers in a window. He's in a staircase. And they're going to use small arms fire here. And the fighter's going to say, he says, this is the room that the soldiers were in. The army doesn't do anything except shoot in the air, because they go to this site after they fire on him. We cut that out because there's some remnants of at least an injured soldier in there. And again, fighting under the rubble, using the military vandalism to their advantage. Let's do 25 here tomorrow. This is the result. The medevac helicopters, one after another, landing with wounded, killed soldiers. Again, well within Al Ghul sniper rifle distance, an armor-piercing incendiary round fired on that helicopter with the acumen that the Qassam snipers have would blow that helicopter up. But here we see bulldozers being towed. We'll run this a couple times so you can see, but here you see an excavator and a bulldozer towing a disabled D9. Let's loop it one more time tomorrow, and you can see, you also see this helicopter this one's going out, but this one coming in is a near miss there, clipping his tail. But look at that distance. That is well within sniper distance of an Al Ghul rifle. We've also seen Qassam use man-portable air defense systems that went on the ground. Look at here. We see a convoy, with an excavator, a bulldozer, and a second bulldozer. So three armored vehicles towing a tank, dragging a tank. That's what it takes to drag a 62-ton, 70-ton tank. It takes an excavator, two bulldozers to drag their vehicles out. And that is something also. We saw a number of M113 troop carriers. I'll dig into that more in the coming weeks. Israel's using remote-controlled M113s, the old armored personnel. There you see it. See how many it takes to drag the tank? So that they're not leaving these tanks behind, but they did leave the M113s behind that are remote control, unmanned. They use them for carrying mines, and they've used them as kamikaze vehicles, like stacking them with mines and blowing up a building using them. So that is the resistance report from Shujaiya. Again, heroic battles ongoing. Shujaiya is the Israelis left, and when they withdrew right across the border. They didn't stay at all anywhere near in a position around Shujaiya, and they allowed they were chased out of Shujaiya, and it gave a lot of footage of Palestinians, a lot of kids making funny jokes about the pieces of equipment that were all over. Pieces of the tanks that we just watched were lying all over Shujaiya. So that is the resistance report for this week. We went Rafah, Tel El Hawa, and Shujaiya. And for the next week, we'll be having keeping our eyes on Rafah going forward. But that is the resistance report for this week.
Wow.
They're still busy.
So busy. And like you said, you know, 9 months of Israelis not understanding the concept of windows or curtains.
Or claiming their casualties. You just watch a video like that and you tell me there's no casualties or three casualties. Like, come on. It's just a joke.
Right. And of course, like we see the Israeli High Court, you know, approving a bill that would draft, like do mandatory military drafting of ultra-Orthodox Israeli citizens, which is a new move and which kind of speaks to the level of, attrition of its soldiers. And you also, like, there were some reports this week saying that Israel is running out of tanks, and they're using, and this is something that you covered weeks ago, but they're using like training tanks. There's a lot more that we are not being told that is
well,
being
we get little, that's why we get little nuggets of it, right? They don't tell us the truth, but that came out, what you're saying came out because of a Supreme Court case about women being put into mechanized, into armored brigades. And so it came out in the course of that Supreme Court challenge that they don't have enough tanks.
We can actually show the story. Okay. Tamara, if you want to put up the story from Ynet. This is, of course, the major Israeli news site, Yediot Ahronot, reporting on this. And what this story says, it's by Yoav Zitun, which regular viewers will know is Ynet's military correspondent, who's revealed many nuggets, important nuggets of information over the past few months. And it says here, the IDF said on Monday that it has a shortage of tanks after many were damaged in the war. Ammunition was also in short supply, the military said in court filings in response to a motion brought before the Supreme Court. According to the filing, the military chief of staff decided to delay incorporating women in fighting positions until November 2025 due to the severe shortage in the armored corps arsenal. I'm still quoting from the article. This is the first time that the IDF has openly admitted to a shortage of equipment and munitions, as well as officers and enlisted men, after many were killed or injured since the war broke out in October. Quote, the number of operational tanks in the Corps is insufficient for the needs of the war and for conducting experiments of the deployment of women, end quote. The IDF wrote in its response to the court, we are working to increase the arsenal. So that's really an extraordinary admission, and I think it bears out everything we've been seeing in the videos that we've been watching week after week now for almost 10 months.
Yeah, there was in the Israeli press about a week and a half ago, there was an allusion to 500 tanks being damaged. And that the damage of a tank, it's not like your car. You don't take it into the shop and get it a new bumper put on. The time to turn around a damaged, and some of these tanks are a lot more than damaged, as we've seen. Turning those around takes a long time, longer than it takes many months. In some cases, it takes years. And this is the force that they're saying is going to invade Lebanon. And the training brigades is also a secondary part of it, because they don't have, the training brigades have to be deployed in Gaza. They need those troops being deployed in Gaza. They were deployed. The training brigade was deployed during the Jabalia camp raid a couple months ago. And when that training brigade rotated out, that's what ended the operation in the Jabalia camp. The other two brigades couldn't carry out the fight without the third brigade. And that training brigade rotated out. So they all rotated out. So it's even impacting their battle plans, insofar as Israel has battle plans beyond just destroying. They're not able to achieve it because they're short on weaponry. They're also short on munitions. And we're hearing soldiers being told to use different munitions. They're running low on 155, 155 millimeter shells. Howitzer shells that they rain terror down on Gaza civilians. Because I covered the battlefields in this report, but of course, as Nora's report shows, the bombings and the artillery shelling, that happens all over the Gaza Strip. They're not battlefield specific. They're raining down those shells constantly, and literally in the hundreds of thousands of them. Early in the war, they said they had used 100,000. It was still in November, and that included a period of time of the 10-day prisoner exchange pause. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands of these shells being rained down. And so there's a shortage of those if you want to go to war in Lebanon as well. So there's, I think, a lot of bluster happening from the Israelis. They don't seem to show their materiel, their manpower, and even their military acumen is not prepared to expand this war into Lebanon under these conditions, as we're seeing it right now. And if they are, it's going to be a catastrophe for them.
Yeah. Well, we have a couple of topics of discussion, just snippets of news over the last few days. Ali, I know that a new Human Rights Watch report came out.
Yes.
Give us a sense of the significance of it and what the basic issues are.
Well, this was published today, and it's more than 200 pages, so I couldn't tell you I've read the whole thing, but I've looked at it, and it's disappointing, to say the least, that Human Rights Watch took what is now a very tired, both-sides-y approach, trying to pin on Palestinians all sorts of crimes. And this is really just, again, it's more than 200 pages, so I haven't read the whole report. I've just sort of focused in on some issues that I'm very well versed in as a good way to kind of test how the report deals with them. And there's some quite shocking elements to this, but before I get to that, I will say that despite the biases of this report, despite its attempt to be both sidesy and to show Palestinians as committing all sorts of crimes, you know, again, there may be violations in the standards of international law, but I feel like they were really trying to look for something. And yet, this report that really bends over backwards in that way is the latest body to find that there is no verifiable evidence for the mass rape. So, Tamara, maybe we can put up that little snippet of the report that I indicated earlier. And there you can see under the title, Crimes Involving Acts of Sexual and Gender-Based Violence, they say, quote, Human Rights Watch was not able to gather verifiable information through interviews with survivors or of witnesses to rape during the assault on October 7th. So that's the bottom line there. Even though they sort of swaddle this in all sorts of language, which is to say, well, maybe it happened. We may never know. We may never find out. But the bottom line is they couldn't find, you know, Human Rights Watch, a multi tens of million dollar organization with all its researchers and resources could not find any verifiable evidence. So that's one thing. The other thing to point out about this is they rely on Zaka as a source. Now they claim, oh, we're very careful and we corroborate things, but they rely on Zaka, the ultra-Orthodox extremist Jewish organization that we've talked about many times, about how they were instrumental in inventing and disseminating many of the October 7th atrocity propaganda and lies, burned children, the rape hoax, a fetus cut out of a mother, all things that turned out to be absolute lies. And Human Rights Watch is still taking Zaka seriously, quite shocking. Another thing that shocked me, Tamara, you can put that second snippet back up, is they looked at the issue of what happened in Kibbutz Be'eri at Pessy Cohen's house. This was the incident that we've covered many times where Israeli General Barak Hiram ordered a tank to fire shells at this house where more than a dozen Israelis were being held captive by Palestinian fighters. And shockingly, from what I've read, Human Rights Watch whitewashes this. They say here, the operative sentence, the fighter that after Israeli tanks opened fire on the home, the fighters were killed, as well as 12 hostages who were killed in the crossfire. That word crossfire is a whitewashing word, which is designed to make it seem like, oh, there was a battle and, you know, these people just died. How unfortunate. They were killed by the Israeli tank shelling. And I'll just give people a sneak preview here that our colleague David Sheen and I are working on a new article about the Israeli army's own whitewash of this shelling ordered by Barak Hiram in Kibbutz Be'eri, which appears to be an application of the Hannibal directive that Asa talked about last week and on previous programs regarding Israel deliberately killing its own people or acting with total disregard, at the very least, for the lives of its own citizens. So I just wanted to sort of say that about the Human Rights Watch report, again, with the caveat that I haven't read the whole thing. But, you know, those are just some things that leapt out at me on a very initial reading. And in fact, the report itself, in all 200 plus pages, does not mention the Hannibal directive. Doesn't mention it in the Human Rights Watch report. Incredible. And that's especially shocking after the revelations, which Asa talked about in last week's program, of the Israeli army itself admitting the widespread use of the Hannibal directive, of it being ordered from the first hours of October 7th until well into the evening, turning the Gaza boundary area into, quote, a killing zone, that every vehicle was to be fired on. Again, these are the things that Asa talked about last week, and people can find that segment on the Electronic Intifada YouTube channel if they haven't seen it or they want to watch it again. And that's not addressed in any serious way in the Human Rights Watch report.
The idea there was a crossfire was really misleading as well. This is kind of the Israeli narrative, really. But if you read what actually happened, according to the two surviving civilian eyewitnesses, they say the Palestinian fighters were actually negotiating. And it was the Israeli forces who fired when they arrived. They fired on the home immediately. And then this, they're trying to make out that, oh, there was a tank, there was tank fire, as if like it was almost accidental. It was very much not accidental. It was a way to, according to Barak Hiram, he said that he wanted to end the negotiations. The negotiations were over, and so we're going to fire on the home.
Yeah, and as I say, we'll be looking at the Israeli army's recently published so-called investigation, but it's actually a cover-up in this upcoming article. So I'm sure we'll be saying more about this.
Yeah. The story that just won't go away. The other, just very quickly, I wanted to bring up some new reports that have been circulating about the Israeli economy. Some reports in Israeli media, and then here we have Al-Mayadeen offering a summary of it, saying that 46,000 businesses have closed since October 7th. And just to, like, I'm not a math guy, but I had my friend Ghassan help me crunch numbers about what this means in real terms. And let's say that, you know, for these small businesses, which are, you know, minimum 5 employees, 46,000 businesses at 5 employees each mean that there's about 230,000 employees now that don't have jobs in Israel as the economy continues to take a nosedive, which is about 2.3% of the population. This is compounded with Israel's GDP, which has also taken a nosedive, and I believe the quarterly GDP numbers aren't out yet, but last quarter it was, I think, 20% that has been decreased for Israel's GDP. What does this mean? I mean, you know, there's it's pretty significant that Israel's economy is on the brink, that it is collapsing societally and economically, politically. Everything that, you know, Ilan Pappe said a few months ago on this podcast, Shir Hever said recently. And this is, I mean, what can we make of this?
I think it means that many more Israelis will be trying to follow Yair Netanyahu to Miami or other sunnier climes.
Well, it's definitely something that we're going to keep watching. Let's talk about the Labour UK government in terms of the ICC case against Israel for the genocide.
Yeah, this is something we mentioned on last week's show, mentioning that it had been reported that the new government of Britain, with the new Labour government of Britain, would drop the previous government's objections to the case in the ICC against Israel for war crimes. And it was reported in Israeli media this week, and we've got a story here from Middle East Eye reporting on that report, that would not be the case. And they're backtracking on this decision to drop the British government's objections to ICC arrest warrants. And what was reported in Israeli media in Ma'ariv was that the new foreign minister, David Lammy, who you can see here in this photo on the left, had promised the Israeli government during his visit to Israel, his first visit this week, that he would not be dropping that objection, and that they would be carrying on. And so we can see that the new Labour government is basically carrying on with the same policies as the Tory government.
I actually predicted this last week. I said I would be very surprised if Labour did actually drop its objections. There's a couple of things here to say. One is that according to this Middle East Eye report and other reports, there was not just pressure, direct pressure from Israel, as David Lammy, the new Labour Foreign Secretary of the UK, went to Israel and met with Netanyahu, but also there was pressure from the United States. And if we look back at, and you'd wonder why would the Labour government care what the United States says? Well, I mean, that's a question that answers itself. But if we look at this story from the Washington Post, Tamara, that's actually from 2019, when Jeremy Corbyn, a lifelong supporter of Palestinian rights, was leader of the Labour Party and had a real prospect of becoming prime minister had he not been sabotaged by the right wing of his own Labour Party, as well as the whole British establishment. But this is a reference to Mike Pompeo, who was then Secretary of State for the Trump administration, who suggested the UK, that the United States would take action, possibly to go far as preventing Jeremy Corbyn from becoming prime minister if he won an election. And there are some quotes there from the article, again, from 2019, that Pompeo weighed in on British politics during a closed-door meeting with Jewish leaders, saying he would not wait for Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn to become Prime Minister of Britain to push back against him or any future actions he might take against Britain's Jews. Again, this is feeding the fake anti-Semitism narrative. During his meeting with Jewish leaders in New York, Pompeo was asked, if Corbyn is elected, would you be willing to work with us to take on actions if life becomes very difficult for Jews in the UK? In response, Pompeo said, quote, it could be that Mr. Corbyn manages to run the gauntlet and get elected. It's possible. You should know. We won't wait for him to do those things to begin to push back. We will do our level best. End quote. And those are very significant and weighty words coming not just from a US Secretary of State, but a former head of the CIA, as Mike Pompeo was. And recall that he publicly boasted about how, as head of the CIA, they were organizing coups and sabotage and subversion all over the world. He actually laughed about it. And then the other thing is there's some breaking news that I just found when looking. And Tamara, I'm going to drop this into the chat. This story is from the Jewish News Syndicate, which is a pro-Israel website. And I'm just seeing this now. It's dated July 17th. And it says, the International Criminal Court of The Hague is expected to issue arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant within the next 2 weeks, according to Israel's Channel 14. And if you don't know, Channel 14 is considered to be a very pro-Netanyahu, a specifically pro-Netanyahu channel in Israel. The article continues, Israel had bargained that an unofficial agreement with Britain's previous conservative government would derail the ICC effort, the report said. So I don't know. It said that the reports are contradictory as to whether the Labour Party will drop the challenge. What we can say, I mean, we can't confirm any of this. I just saw this. But what we can say is that this at least tells us that Israel is extremely worried. And of course, even if the British don't drop their challenge, that doesn't mean that the ICC has to care about what the UK thinks. So this issue is still there, and it's not going to go away for Israel, even if Labour continues its policy, continues the policy of the previous Conservative government.
And Ali, just remind us what happened. Like, let's say that the International Criminal Court does issue arrest warrants for these Israeli leaders. What happens next? Is it a universal jurisdiction sort of arrangement where anywhere they are in the world, they can be and should be arrested and brought to The Hague? What happens?
So, yeah, just to remind people, back a month or two ago, when it was, time is warped, yeah. So I don't remember the exact date, but Karim Khan, who is the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, announced his intention to seek arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, the prime minister and defense minister of Israel, in connection with crimes against humanity and war crimes in Gaza. The way the International Criminal Court works is that the prosecutor doesn't have the power himself to issue those arrest warrants. What he does is he makes the request to a panel of judges, and the judges deliberate and decide whether or not to issue the arrest warrants. Historically, this has been a formality. I don't know off the top of my head if they've ever denied an arrest warrant, but typically, the prosecutor will have done his or her homework and the judges will approve the arrest warrants. That process may take weeks or up to 2 months. What happened in this case is that the British government, the previous Conservative government, lodged an objection, and that slowed the whole thing down. And so now the question is whether the court will have to slow down its process, hear that objection, and, you know, set everything back, or whether it will be withdrawn and proceed. So if and when the arrest warrants are issued, every country, every state that is a party to the Rome Statute, the founding document of the International Criminal Court, will be obligated to arrest Benjamin Netanyahu or Yoav Gallant if they set foot on their territory. And that's most of the world's countries and all of Europe and Canada. The notable exception is the United States. They would be able to travel to the United States without fear of arrest, but they couldn't go to Canada, they couldn't go to France, they couldn't go to the UK, all these countries that are closely allied with Israel. And in fact, even Germany, which is a major partner in this genocide, announced at the time that Karim Khan said he was seeking the warrants that if the warrants were issued and if Netanyahu or Gallant set foot on German soil, they would be obligated to comply with the warrants and arrest them. Norway and several other countries made the statement. So it would be a major blow, and the effect would be wider than just Netanyahu and Gallant, because, you know, the court has said, or the prosecutor has said, that we're still actively investigating and more warrants are likely to be issued. But even in the absence of that, this would set such a precedent, it would be such a break in the wall of impunity that Israel has had, that no Israeli soldier, no officer, no Israeli official or politician would feel safe traveling to any country for fear of arrest, either under an international warrant or under universal jurisdiction, which is separate. Universal jurisdiction is the principle where countries can prosecute international crimes like genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes in their own domestic courts. These are considered crimes of such gravity that countries can take them on in their own domestic courts, as has happened, by the way, in the case of certain Syrian officials being convicted in various courts in Europe, I think particularly Germany, for example. So it would really tighten the squeeze on Israel significantly. Whether it's enough to force them to stop the genocide, nothing has so far, but it would certainly be a real tightening of the screws.
Yeah. Well, a lot more to watch on that front, obviously. And finally, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon gave a speech. And did we want to you talk about the significance of that as Lebanon continues to resist Israel's airstrikes over it.
Yeah, I can just a very quick comment on this. This was a very interesting speech which he gave on the occasion of Ashura, which is an important religious observance for Muslims, with a special meaning and significance for Shia Muslims, as it's the day of mourning for Hussein ibn Ali, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad and the third Imam in the Shia tradition, who was martyred at the Battle of Karbala. What was interesting about the speech is that Nasrallah really focused on combating and counteracting sectarianism. So he used the occasion to talk about how Sunni Muslim and Christian communities in Lebanon hosted celebrations for their Shia countrymen on the occasion of Ashura. And he talked about how the U.S. and Israeli effort to foment Shia-Sunni sectarianism as a kind of divide-and-rule tactic has largely been overcome. And it was interesting because that is very much something that we talked about last week with Rania Khalik on this live stream, about how that effort to foment sectarianism had really failed and receded, and that people in the region are seeing through it. But Nasrallah warned that this effort was likely to be revived, that there would be a new push, and he told people to be on their guard. And he really, again, as I mentioned last week, used, as he consistently has, a language of not just Muslim unity, Shia-Sunni Muslim unity, but also unity across all religions within Lebanon and globally. So it was a really interesting speech in terms of that message. And that's just mm-hmm. something I wanted to point out in light of last week's discussion.
Yeah. And sorry to put you on the spot, John, but is there anything that you want to say about Hezbollah's operations against Israel, especially in the north of historic occupied Palestine?
Yeah, I mean, they're just continuing to escalate, and the quality, they put out another 9-minute video of aerial surveillance of the Golan Heights. They know where all the installations are. Nasrallah's speech before the Ashura one was essentially mocking the Israelis, saying, like, you can't take Rafah, you can't take Lebanon. You know, all the villages that are the settlements in the north that are abandoned, they're abandoned from the military as well. So if there's an invasion of Lebanon, they have to re-enter the areas that they have abandoned before they can even begin to invade Lebanon. And I think Nasrallah was pretty clear that he thinks that it's a bluff, that there's nothing in the Israeli military that's been demonstrated in the past 9 months that indicates that they're capable of the war that would be required to fight in South Lebanon.
Yeah. All right. Well, so many stories happening on so many fronts. We're going to keep abreast as well as we can. Before we go, let's take a look at the front page. It's been just, as we said at the beginning, just another bloody and horrifying week on the ground in Gaza. We have several brand new features up. Ali, were there several that spoke to you this week?
So many. I mean, I'll just say that again, just unbelievable respect and awe and love for all our colleagues and friends in Gaza, whose names you see on the front page of the Electronic Intifada today, as every day, as they're writing about what is happening to them, to their families, to their communities. As I said, they are not writing about this genocide from a distance. They are living it. They are trying to survive it. And we are just so unbelievably privileged to be able to feature and amplify their voices. So again, one of the things that I said this last week, and this worry hasn't gone away, my fear is that Gaza will fall out of the headlines. We already see attention drifting. It is up to us to keep it there. And I had an exchange with one of our colleagues in Gaza yesterday. He sent me a beautiful message saying, you know, just from that he would even think to do this from the situation that he's in. And he sent a message to say that he was grateful for the work we're doing. I mean, honestly, it made me feel emotional, because I thought, we're not up to what, you know, our efforts feel much less than they should be. But he said, we see you, we hear you, and it gives us hope. It's what's helping us hold on. That's what he said. And so I just want to amplify to people that their voices are here on this website, and please take them, share them, let people know. I get notes from people sometimes telling me, I print out the articles from the Electronic Intifada, I hand them to friends and family, I give them to people outside the supermarket. Whatever you can do to keep Gaza in people's hearts and in their minds, please continue going out and demonstrating. Please continue telling the politicians, telling the leaders that you care about this, that this matters to you, that this issue isn't going to go away. Because again, that's what our friends in Gaza are telling us. This is what gives us hope, that we're not forgotten, that our struggle, that our suffering is not in silence. And so let's just keep doing that.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ali. And of course, some of the best ways to do that is to sign up for our email list, as we say every week, and subscribe to the YouTube channel. We're also streaming on Facebook and Twitch and Twitter. And just keep amplifying those voices, as Ali said. And we will be back next week. I wanted to give some special thanks, of course, to Tamara Nassar behind the scenes, and also to our senior editor, Maureen Claire Murphy, who helped so much with the pre-production work and the writing, especially of the news report. So thank you, Maureen. And also to Ellie Gerzon, who is helping with the social media production. Thank you so much, Ellie. And on behalf of John and Asa and Ali and Tamara, thank you. And everyone at the Electronic Intifada, thank you all for watching and listening. We'll see you next week.